Hello and welcome to the latest podcast from the Glasgow Centre for Population Health, supporting new approaches to improve health and tackle inequality. In this podcast, Dr. Angela O'Hagan, Reader Inequalities and Public Policy at Glasgow Caledonian University, considers how care is valued and remunerated in the realities of our economic and social infrastructure. This was recorded live on Zoom as part of the GCPH seminar series on the 25th of November 2020.
Right, I hope everybody can hear me okay in this nice bright morning in Scotland. For those of you that don't know me, of which I'm sure there are many, my name's Linda Christie and I'm a postdoctoral fellow at University of Glasgow, Policy Scotland. And today we have the privilege of having Dr. Angela O'Hagan with us, who is a reader in inequalities and public policy at Glasgow Caledonian University, where she's also deputy director of the WISE Centre for Economic Justice. And previous to that, had joined Caledonian University following doing her PhD in gender budgeting. And today we have the privilege of hearing from Angela about the subject of a caring economy. And its importance, really, in terms of social infrastructure relative to economic development. And particularly at this time, during COVID, our social infrastructure and how it's been underinvested, really, has come to the fore and been even more emphasised, alongside the underlying inequalities that we already have in our society. So Angela today is going to outline how the caring economy really is key to economic and social recovery. And I'm very excited to hear about this. In my own research as an economist who's starting to think much more as well about the role of inclusive growth and well-being within economic development, I'm particularly keen to hear about other narratives. And in this context, Angela's contribution relative to how the caring economy can contribute as another narrative within this expansive field. So without further ado, Angela, I'll be handing you over, but just handing over to you. But I just wanted to just mention some housekeeping. For our participants, if you move your cursor to the bottom of your screen, you will see a Q&A and a chat function. So please be welcome to use the chat function, and you can also I think you can also message separately, privately, if you don't want to use that. However, we would encourage you to use the Q&A function, and then at the end, after Angela's been speaking, I'll be able to feed those questions back for Angela to respond to. So really, that's enough from me. Angela, if I hand over to you, please.
Great. Thank you, Linda. And thank you very much to Glasgow Centre for Population and Health for having me back. I gave a lecture last year, so it's always nice to be asked back and not just to apologise for your performance the last time. But I'm really pleased to be here. I was actually booked to talk about this topic earlier in the year, just as COVID hit. The benefit in some ways of doing it now is that the Commission on a Gender Equal Economy, which I'm going to talk about, has reported, and that's the focus of my presentation today, as Linda has said, a focus on the recommendations from the Commission on a Gender Equal Economy, which is a call to action for a caring economy. So we had a wee technical glitch earlier on, which I would attribute most likely to user error, so bear with me while I try to share my presentation. The session's being recorded and I have made a PDF of the presentation available, and all the data I'm using, all the slides I'm using and the references to the Commission on a Gender Equal Economy are all available from the Commission website at the UK Women's Budget Group, and there's a slide at the end there to direct you to that. And there's a wealth of information behind what I'm going to say that I would strongly encourage colleagues to have a look at. So here goes with the slide sharing. I'm hoping to talk for no more than about 40 minutes and then to have a conversation with yourselves. So here goes. Great. So, the Commission on a Gender Equal Economy was funded by Friends Provident as a project through the Women's Budget Group. And from the outset, we were looking to, well, what is currently wrong with our economy, with our economic models, with the way we think about the economy, and what that means for women and men, for our economic, social, cultural, and health well-being. And it's been clear to many of us for a long time that the economic model that informs our public policy thinking needs to, it currently does not take a gendered lens to how we live our lives, how institutions are structured, how the institution of the economy and other institutions are structured. And so we wanted to think, well, what do we need to do differently in our economy?
Sorry, Angela, but just saying, can you put your slides onto SlideShare? Is that possible?
It's still not working.
Because you can see just now is the slide sorter. How about from the beginning, if you can do it that way?
I've got two screens and one showing me that it's showing.
Right.
And the rest is just taking its time. Everything's going really slowly, I'm sorry.
Okay.
No, it's not liking that.
Just take your time, don't.
Resume slideshow, let's give that a go. No, it's not moving from here. I'll stop and try again. Okay. So the Commission started, we reported, sorry, I'll start at the end. The Commission started, reported on the 30th of September this year. And we had met over the previous 18 months, taking evidence in Glasgow, Belfast, Cardiff, London, Sheffield, as well as lots and lots of commissioned pieces. It's still not working, is it?
Is there a wee button or anything at the bottom that's allowing you to share it, Angela? No.
No. It's telling me.
Yeah.
This one, see if it moves. Sorry, everybody. Right, let's see if I move it on. It's just got stuck on that side.
There you go. Now that's at least better for you, because then maybe you could just minimise the panel at the side, and that'll be you. I think I know it's not screen share, but it's almost working. That seems fine. Can everybody? I think everybody can see that. Okay.
It's really annoying.
With that. Yeah, everybody looks quite content with that, Angela, so just let you...
All righty. Right, I'll just crack on. That's going to make it worse. Sorry. So we took evidence from across the UK, from women's organisations, from government, from civil society organisations, and came up with a series of recommendations, which I'm going to go on to. But during the time of our second phase of deliberations, we were into COVID times, and what the pandemic, as we all know, has revealed is the extent of the really entrenched inequalities in the UK and globally. What we know is the effects of years of austerity on public services, the withdrawal of public services, that erosion of infrastructure. And what we've seen is the capacity for resilience of individuals and of communities. And one of the things as a commission we were saying is when faced with crisis, care and kindness come to the fore. But arguably, we shouldn't have to rely on care and kindness. Clapping on the doorstep takes us so far as an expression of thanks, an expression of respect. But investment in our care infrastructure and in our care workers would take us a lot further. And what Absolutely, the pandemic has revealed is that key workers have kept us going, and that those key workers have been in occupations which are highly dominated by women, in social care, in healthcare, and in retail. And they are all occupational areas which have traditionally been undervalued socially and financially in terms of the quality of the terms and conditions and remuneration in these jobs. What we've also seen across the pandemic is that government intervention is possible and powerful. Governments can act quickly to address trenchant social problems, from rough sleeping to food poverty, but again have shown the role of the third sector and of community organisations as essential in that infrastructure, and where the gaps are in public services and public infrastructure. And what we do know is that the crisis of COVID, just as any other crisis, has not impacted everybody equally. The pre-existing inequalities based on gender, race, class, disability have been made so much worse. And those pre-existing inequalities have created unequal conditions, meaning that the impact of COVID economically, socially, and in terms of our health and well-being have been so much worse. Glasgow Disability Alliance has repeatedly said over the summer that the COVID crisis has supercharged the inequalities that disabled people experience. But what we also know, and the pandemic has reinforced, is that when we talk about the economy, actually we're talking about ourselves. We, the people, make and sustain the economy and human life. That the economy doesn't exist just on paper in a series of tables and complex graphs and aggregates, but it's a human endeavour, and this affects us all, but it doesn't affect us all equally. So our deliberations were around what kind of a world do we want to create and what kind of economy do we want to make. And in our deliberations, we started from an understanding of the entrenched inequality, that current models had scant regard for the well-being of individuals and the planet, that we were seeing the degradation of well-being in our own lives and in our environment, and the acceleration of climate change, and that current models privilege a focus on short-term financial interests rather than long-term investment. And that's why our core focus is on a sustained investment in care that should be at the core of our economy. And our interim report called Spirals of Inequality is essentially a large graphic that shows all these intersections. So I'd thoroughly encourage you to have a look at that and the documents around that. But what it also reinforced is what we already know, that the economy, the formal economy, doesn't count unpaid work. But unpaid work is what sustains the so-called productive economy, and that women carry out 60% more unpaid work than men. And it's particularly women in their late 20s to mid 30s that are doing that work. So the next section, I want to look a little bit about what we know about some of the impacts of the COVID disruption, and how that has, I think, reinforced, has really fueled the calls for a caring economy. So what we've seen and what we were seeing over the summer were some very highly gendered impacts of the economic, social disruption of COVID, a loss of jobs, a loss of income, reduction in working hours, reduction in withdrawal of services and support, the withdrawal of childcare services. It had a massive economic effect immediately, and maybe for the first time made people realise just how dependent paid economic activity is on the provision of childcare services. We were seeing headlines all through the summer: women are the sacrificial lambs of the childcare crisis. Is gender equality being pushed back to the 1950s? As childcare services weren't functioning, couldn't open, there was a supposition of working from home. But that reinforced the double shift for many. And what the Time News data tells us is that women and men were not sharing childcare and other caring responsibilities at home on an equal basis. While men did increase on the 2014-2015 time use data, it's still not an equal distribution of unpaid labour in the home. So what we were seeing was a return to the kind of default dependence on the reserve army of women type arguments. As well, there were some other structural issues and some issues around policy, particularly focusing on statutory sick pay for low paid workers, the job retention scheme, again, not reflecting low paid workers and pushing income down for many people, again, highly, highly gendered. And while there was an increase of disruption across all occupations, 77% in high exposure of occupational risk to disruption were women. And due to the sectoral and occupational segregation within the labour market, the financial impact there was greater. The persistence of the pay gap, even in sectors where women dominate, like the social care sector, there was still a higher impact of reduced income. And that 30% of jobs in the shutdown sectors were held by lone parents. So retail, hospitality, so the so-called flexibility in those jobs, in those sectors, obviously there will be a higher preponderance of lone parents who require that kind of flexibility in paid work, but 91% of lone parents are women. And women are by far the majority of part-time workers. So again, reductions in hours, etc., all affecting women's incomes. All of these factors contributing very significantly to stress and well-being experiences, particularly for younger women parents. Currently, and unpaid carers, 60% of unpaid carers are women. If we were to publicly fund the level of care currently provided by unpaid carers, we're looking at around just under £11 billion. So it's a huge amount of care that is provided that has very significant implications for individuals' well-being, for their economic and social well-being, for their ability to access paid employment outside the home, etc. The social care and healthcare workforces are significant employers of women, 83 and 76% respectively. What we also saw, as well as the withdrawal of childcare services in Scotland, the expansion of childcare provision, which has been a flagship policy of the Scottish Government in recent years, was delayed. And that and if that delay were to continue, there's all sorts of implications there in terms of access to paid employment, as well as access to education and training. As I say, these increases, these stresses increased a number of stress factors, including higher levels of anxiety, lower levels of well-being, young women parents particularly experiencing higher levels of anxiety. If we look to the bottom there, 43% of young women parents already running out of money over the summer. And that's been a constant, really, that concern to make ends meet, to be able to pay for food for their families and for their children, even while they're being, the pressures from employers. We understand employers are under pressure, but employees have been under pressure to increase their workload, while at the same time their wages have been going down. So anticipating increased debt and what young parents worrying about being able to meet their housing costs. So there's some highly significant health implications here in terms of these additional stresses. Some of the policy responses that have been enacted or certainly have been campaigned for included an increase to £50, a £50 increase rather, in child benefits. That the benefits cap, and the rate clause that we know is an excruciating form of discrimination against women should be removed, that there should be a real living wage for all workers, there needs to be better gender balance in decision making, and an improvement in how services and the impact of spending decisions, including decisions to withdraw spending from previous commitments, needs to be assessed. That job retention and support schemes need to build in the flexibility for part-time protections and include childcare costs, and that we know Black and minority ethnic women have the intersection of race and gender and class here has resulted in even further economic pressures on Black and minority ethnic women, and particularly migrant women whose immigration status means that they have no recourse to public funds, means that we have that there needs to be intervention for the most vulnerable people in our society. And all of this needs intersectional gendered analysis and data to inform a care-led economic renewal and a reshaping of the economy and public policy with value and care provision at its heart. And in Scotland, I know we've got colleagues joining us from across Europe, so my apologies for being Scotland-centric. We had high hopes, some of us, for the advisory group on economic reform, or economic recovery rather, but arguably that could have gone quite a bit further in how it approached the whole question of investment in care. I say this next thing as the independent chair of the Scottish Government's Equality and Budgets Advisory Group, and it's clear that we've been trying for 20 years, but we need to continue to try harder to improve the transparency of our budget process and to improve the quality and consistency of equality and human rights analysis across our public spending. And we need to protect the spend commitments to childcare expansion. And while there's been a lot of talk about community resilience, there needs to be an accompanying public finance reform to support that public resilience. And there are a lot of positives that we can draw harder on in Scotland around community wealth building, around some of the discussion on inclusive growth, as Linda mentioned in the introduction, as well as looking at our procurement and what that means in terms of procurement at the local level, and to have that linking to community empowerment and improved participation and greater diversity in participation. So these are all some of the background that's swirling around the caring economy. So our proposition seems very straightforward, as in the Commission and elsewhere, for a caring economy to be at the core of our economic model. Because through a caring economy, we're addressing and realising, we're advancing gender equality, greater environmental sustainability, and improved and enhanced wellbeing. We proposed 8 steps. I'm not going to go through them all in detail. But firstly, to re-envision what we mean by the economy. And that re-envisioning means an increased investment in physical and social infrastructure, that we need to rethink work, and that we need to transform the worlds of paid and unpaid work. We need investment in a caring social security system based on dignity and autonomy. We need some transformation in our tax systems across the UK. We need to refocus our fiscal and monetary policy on building a caring economy. Working to develop a trade system that is socially, environmentally sustainable, and to transform the international economic system so that unpaid work is recognised. So very quickly, on re-envisioning the economy, we need to be thinking about the value, the economic value of unpaid work, and who's providing that unpaid work, and what contribution that makes to our well-being, our economic, social and health well-being. And that we need to think about different ways of measuring our economic well-being beyond GDP, that actually include an aggregate well-being indicator. And I know Catherine Trebeck from the Wellbeing Economy Alliance has spoken very eloquently for Glasgow Centre for Population Health events on this. We need to also reimagine costs, what we're talking about when we talk about costs, efficiency and productivity, so that the social value, the environmental value and the well-being value as well as unpaid time, are taken into account rather than only the market value, and perhaps to stop thinking about care as a drag on our economy, but to start thinking and that care provision is a cost, but rather there is a very significant return, not only the very significant return that has been demonstrated through repeated studies across OECD economies on investment in care, investment in social and physical infrastructure such as care services and facilities, produces significantly more economic returns than investment in other areas. And that investment produces more jobs, that those jobs are greener than other types of jobs. There's more jobs for women, but also more jobs for men in the care economy, in the care sector, as well as people being able to access increased hours or education and training or different types of work because they can access increased care provision, as well as improving the quality and quantity of care provision for people looking for care services and support, who in turn make a very significant contribution to our economic, cultural and social life through their own participation. So the main argument here is about a rethink on care as not being seen as a drag or as a negative cost to our economy, but as a positive in our well-being, our social well-being, our economic well-being and our health well-being, all of which would generate a positive economic return. So covering its costs, if you like. And that requires all economic policies to be properly assessed and bold action taken to mitigate the negative impacts. Now, in Scotland, we've been looking or waiting for a reform of the public sector equality duty for some time. And I think there's plenty of opportunity there for public authorities to step up in terms of their equalities analysis, but to see that process as enabling better policymaking rather than as some kind of encumbrance or additional administrative burden. But it's actually about better policymaking if there's better equalities analysis at the outset. So to continue on investing in social and physical infrastructure, we're talking about sustainable and adequate funding at all levels of government, so local government, Scottish Government, UK Government, and ensuring that procurement prioritises equality, well-being and sustainability rather than lowest financial cost. And reform of public sector procurement is also central to any notions of a universal care service, which I know is not, you know, that there are concerns around that. And certainly from the Commission's point of view, we're not talking about recreating an NHS or another monolithic structure, but rather that there should be an expectation of the same quality of care services wherever anybody lives. And that the service should be structured in such a way as to give voice as priority to those people who are in receipt of care, and that choice and control actually means choice and control for the individual, and that care is provided by a well-trained and well-paid workforce wherever you happen to be. And that requires some flexibilities in procurement. And I think it goes without saying as well, free universal childcare provision and increased investment in healthcare. Violence against women and girls, social housing and affordable housing also go hand in hand, but are fundamental to investment in social and physical infrastructure, as is an improvement in a high quality green public transport system and a well-funded education system that should include better education on the causes and consequences of inequalities and stereotyping and stereotypical attitudes to employment and to diversity and intersectionality. Transforming the worlds of paid and unpaid work, making it easier to combine paid work and caring responsibilities. One of the phrases we use in the Commission's report is that people should have time to care and time free from care, then we can't continue to grind down unpaid carers the way that's happening just now. And that people should be able to have some choice and some control in the care that they provide. And that there is a role here for employers and for flexible working, for alternative ways of working to be much more than some of the superficial or lip service. And again, the experience of COVID for many people has demonstrated the range of alternative working patterns that are possible, but it has also shown us where within the labour market increased pressures will fall. So in fulfilment, in supply side, in supply chain, in deliveries through increased in online shopping, etc. And who's occupying those jobs. So we need to have an eye to the terms and conditions that will be facing people. And part of that is ensuring a real living wage for everyone, as well as increasing the diversity and innovation in forms of business ownership. Investing in a caring social security system based on dignity and autonomy. For those of us living in Scotland, as the social security system migrates to Scotland and we're in the process of establishing a social security system in Scotland, which is premised on a human rights based approach, that language of dignity and autonomy has become, you know, has come much more to the fore but than it perhaps elsewhere in the UK. But we were very clear in the Commission that dignity has to be safeguarded by the withdrawal of punitive and unreasonable sanctions in the first instance and the enhancement of individuals' autonomy and an increase in carers' allowance for those providing long-term unpaid care, recognising the costs of caring. I'm moving quite quickly through all of these things now. Transforming the tax systems across the UK. There's lots of discussion to have around that. I know the UK Chancellor is making his statement today on the spending review. So we're going to see, it'll be interesting to see if there's any discussion on tax. There's discussion on tax with the Scottish Government as well. But one of the things that they can do straight away is to increase corporation tax and remove us from being amongst the lowest in the G20. And to address tax avoidance and tax evasion and to honour our human rights duties to secure the maximisation of available resources for the progressive realisation of rights. Again, topical today for those of us in the UK, the fiscal and monetary policy and questions around borrowing. Is current government spending sustainable? Do we need to pay it all back? How do we pay it back? Some very heated discussions on different radio programmes already this morning about all of that. And to develop a trade system. Now that can feel very remote if we're talking about social care at a community level, but as in the UK, as we stand on the precipice of Brexit, it's imperative that our healthcare and our social care is not traded off in such a way that we have no control over the quality and core concern for well-being in health and social care. Now, are we a pie in the sky think tank that's just, you know, huddled together in a room and thought up all these changes? No, we're not. And as I said at the start, the Commission was informed by evidence from across the UK, from a whole range of perspectives, as well as a whole series of commissioned papers. We also took our recommendations out to polling and tested them with members of the public across the UK. And it's clear that people want change. Significant numbers of people saying that well-being should be used to measure the success of our economy. 70, almost 80% agreeing a better balance is needed between paid work and caring responsibilities. And over half of those polled believing that investment in social care, health and education is more important than investing in transport and technology. And significant numbers of people agreeing that economic equality between women and men is the mark of a good society, and that for over half of the people polled, it was a political priority. So it's not a second order marginalised or marginal group interest. People want to see greater gender equality. and that social care, there was very strong support for social care to be made available to everyone based on their care needs and not their wealth. And that there should be changes in legislation and in government policy to support, to address the divisions of unpaid labour between women and men. So, interestingly, and particularly as well in Scotland, we're looking at Scottish Parliament elections next year. So for people who have an eye to political manifestos, here's some data for you. And in terms of what we, you know, there's a kind of constant refrain that, you know, people don't want to pay tax. We don't want to talk about tax. But people do seem to want to talk about tax and are willing to pay more in tax to make certain changes happen. And those changes include pay rises and decent wages for key workers, including NHS and care staff, a higher living wage, investment in childcare, and investment in free social care for all adults. Now, 75% of those polled saying there should be net more tax directed at these areas of spend. And a large proportion of the population believing that well-being and a standard of life should be used to measure the success of government economic policy. So when we talk, you know, when we're talking about economic successes and listening to, you know, the successes of shovel-ready projects and hard hat construction, when we have 1.5 million families in food poverty going into the pandemic, is that really a measure of our economic success? So there's popular support to change how we think about our economy, and I think to change as well what it is we're prepared to tolerate as a society. Can we tolerate, and should we tolerate, that level of food poverty in the UK in 2020? So well-being and standard of life, our economic growth compared with other countries, and greater equality. And in Scotland, so let's look a wee bit across the UK. Who thought what? So in the UK and in Northern Ireland, there's strong support for the idea of well-being and standard of life as a measure of success. Broadly similar views across women and men, high support from Black and Asian and ethnic minority people. Across the age range, there's an increase, you know, as we go up the age ranges, there's an increase in support. Interestingly, some of the data around household income levels and levels of support. But again, if household incomes are already under the types of pressure that they are, then conversations on taxation are challenging. In Scotland, we've seen higher support for women and men to share responsibilities equally, and that economic equality should be a political priority. So very high numbers of support for all of these provisions in Scotland, and that the NHS, social care and economic growth, but the type of economic growth we're talking about in the Commission are all spending priorities, and that progressive tax increases were the most popular method to fund the recovery.